It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, lovers and makers of lace are keeping traditions alive in Iowa and around the world. We'll find out more. But first, between 1976 and 1978, a Marxist government in Ethiopia killed as many as 500,000 of the country's citizens. The turmoil began with the overthrow of the emperor in 1974, and chaos and violence grew when a militant group known as the Derg took over. As the situation got worse, the Bascom family, once missionaries in Ethiopia, watched from their safe home in Kansas. Tim Bascom was a teenager at the time. He is now the director of creative writing at Waldorf College in Forest City, and he's written about that time in his memoir, Running to the Fire, An American Missionary Comes of Age in Revolutionary Ethiopia. Hello, Tim.
Yeah, hi there, Charity.
Oh, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be with you.
So you spent a significant portion of your childhood in Ethiopia before this time that you write about in your memoir. How long were you there as a child?
We were there about 5 years, starting when I was only 3 years old up to the age of 8 or 9. And I went off to boarding school when I was in second grade in Addis Ababa as my parents were working at a station in the south.
And your father was a doctor, so he was doing medical work?
Correct. He ran a hospital, basically. There were just a couple of nurses and him, and he would adjust to whatever came in the door. He'd been trained as a general practitioner, but took on whatever came.
What do you think drew your parents to Ethiopia in the first place?
Well, they had this strong conviction after kind of radical conversion experiences in college that they should be going somewhere else and telling others about what they now believed. And they looked at Asia and parts of it, and then they were asked by somebody who had worked in Ethiopia if they would come there, largely because they needed medical workers. And my parents have always been kind of inclined to do what they felt was needed. So that led them into Ethiopia.
And you were there for about 5 years. Why did you leave? What brought you back to Kansas?
We left for a couple of reasons. It's kind of complicated. I had myself become ill with something that we later identified as just loosely called pigeon fever. Kids used to have pet pigeons at the boarding school, and they would feed them by mouth, having chewed up grain. And I had contracted this fever that stayed for 6 months or more. I had to be sent home and taught at home kind of as an invalid. My grandmother at the same time had a heart attack back in Hiawatha, Kansas. And my parents, to be honest, had reached kind of their limit in the work they were doing, I think becoming a bit disillusioned and worn down. So we kind of returned as a basket case to Kansas and recuperated for a number of years before Dad brought us together and said, what would you think about returning?
So as you're in Kansas and having now a pretty typical teenage experience in the United States, going to junior high, all of these events are going on in Ethiopia. Your parents are just waiting on news with bated breath, watching the political situation develop. What was your level of interest at that point?
I had become a Kansas boy. I think to some extent I had set aside that past. It wasn't easy to bring up. Kids at the school might ask me questions like, you know, did you live in trees? Did you eat monkeys? Were you wearing any clothes? These weren't things that I wanted to talk about. So I had set it aside, learned how to play American football, gone out as a high school kid and started to lift hay in the summer, and wasn't thinking a lot about it. But, you know, internally, as I heard about what had happened to Emperor Haile Selassie, was becoming concerned and feeling that something unjust was occurring on the other side of the world, back where we used to be. And so when my parents started to talk with us about this possibility of returning, I kind of had a strong sense of American right, concern as a Christian in the evangelical subculture that something terrible was happening over there with the Marxists and the communists in Ethiopia, and was willing to say, yeah, I would go back when asked.
Throughout your memoir, you take moments to address us from the present and talk about how when you're looking back now, you can see things differently. And this is a point at which you and your family were very clearly looking at the events that were going on in Ethiopia, not just from the perspective of Americans and as Christians, but really everything that you saw was through that lens of faith. And you brought up Emperor Haile Selassie, mm-hmm. who was really a hero of yours and of your family. And he had been the subject of a lot of propaganda against him from the Marxists, but it also turned out to be true. And that wasn't something that you were willing or able to see at that time.
Right. At first, I just found it hard to believe that he was at fault the way that he actually was. He had ignored a famine that was occurring in northern Ethiopia. It was an embarrassment. He didn't want the rest of the world to know about it, even though hundreds of farmers had come south walking by foot to tell him, we're dying, you have to do something. These were things that were hard for me to accept, and it was only over time that I began to see how much wealth he had amassed as well, and also to see that the aristocracy of Ethiopia had unfairly ruled the country for generation after generation, for literally 1,500 years, as landlords owning most of the country and requiring everyone as peasants or serfs to pay tax on the land that they farmed, sometimes half of the crops that they grew. So there was a good reason why this revolution occurred, and when people took to the streets saying land the tiller, they had a very good cause for being outraged, and that had led to the revolution.
So when you and your family arrived there, did you have any kind of a feeling that the revolution was justified in any way?
At that time, no. Being raised the way I had in that kind of hyper-religious missionary culture, I was just conscious that communists were people who didn't believe in God. They were atheists, and it seemed from what we were hearing, that a lot of injustice was occurring, and in fact it was.
Right.
The people that were associated with the mission were being blacklisted, labeled, found, hunted down, put in jail, tortured, sometimes killed. Jails were being nailed shut or burnt to the ground. And a lot of these people had not incited any of that. It just came down upon them. And so I walked into it as a 16-year-old, the way that I suppose, I think there's a reason that people that age end up signing up for war. You know, I had a strong sense of what was the moral right, and felt like I was there to support my own parents in what was a good cause.
And drawn to the excitement and the danger.
Yes, yes. In a way, I wrote the book because I began wondering, why would that year, with all the trauma that it involved, be one of the best years of my life? And that's a complex question to answer. But one of the reasons was that it was adventurous. It was exciting. And I felt like I was right on the edge of history, you know, right in it, contributing to it. And that we were doing something that was larger than us and important.
As a parent yourself now, how do you think about the fact that, you know, all of these things were going on and people who were associated with the missions in Ethiopia were being jailed, were being killed, And your parents made the decision to go back to Ethiopia and to take you and your younger brother along with them. And that seems like a very, very difficult decision for a parent to make.
It is. And would it be okay to read you something?
I'd love that.
This is sort of a way to answer that question. It's part of that second layer of the book, which is more the voice of experience looking back on what had happened as a child. And I'll just jump in. A few years ago, I was laughing my way through a set of old family photo albums with the usual grainy and half-focused snapshots of family members hamming it up when I came upon my parents' wedding album and flipped to this scripture verse inscribed on the first page, "For me to live is Christ and to die is gain." It was a shock to see this mutual pledge of allegiance, as if to borrow a phrase from the Revolutionary War hero Patrick Henry, my parents had proclaimed at the wedding altar, "Give us Jesus or give us death." Yet I suppose I shouldn't have been stunned, given the way my parents had always lived, including the year 1977 when they took us into the middle of a communist battle zone. The verse they chose for their marriage pledge is, as you may have guessed, a verse from one of the epistles of Paul, who was in jail at the time, awaiting possible execution. Unfazed, he boasted that he was ready to die, since dying would be gain. It is this attitude that has made Paul the enduring poster boy of missionary recruitment, a sort of biblical supermarine. As the first real missionary of the Christian church, he logged up 14,000 miles, taking the good news to the ends of the earth as he understood it, even though that meant shipwreck, whippings, stoning, repeated jailing, and eventual death. His efforts to reach unbelievers in places such as Tarsus, Corinth, Thessalonica, Rome, building up a new Christian empire, pitted him directly against the military might of the Roman Empire.
And Tim, we're going to have to leave it there because we have to take a short break.
Okay.
That's Tim Bascom. He's reading from his memoir, Running to the Fire, An American Missionary Comes of Age in Revolutionary Ethiopia. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, a conversation about lace, making lace the old-fashioned way in about 20 minutes. With me right now is Tim Bascom. He's the author of his latest memoir, Running to the Fire, An American Missionary Comes of Age in Revolutionary Ethiopia. He's also the director of creative writing at Waldorf College in Forest City. And Tim, before the break, you were reading a little bit from the book, which shed some light on your parents' relationship, but also their faith. Even in their marriage vows and their marriage ceremony, they were
right,
pledging to each other to really fight for their faith.
Yeah, they basically felt that though we'd be kind of running into the fire, which became the title of this book, that there would be no place safer than right there in what they considered the will of God.
So they believed that God would protect you?
Yeah. I think that's the way they looked at it, and if they did what God required of them, we would be okay. An issue that remains somewhat of a sore point for me as I look back at it, though I respect the way they lived life with discipline and principle.
When you went to Ethiopia, you and your younger brother were separated from your parents pretty quickly. As you mentioned, you were sent off to boarding school when you were in second grade, when you were living in Ethiopia before. Here mm-hmm. you are again, and you knew you would be going back to boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually knew a number of the other students because you had known them from before. Can you kind of describe this community that you became a part of at boarding school? Most or all, were all of the kids you were at school with children of missionaries?
Yeah, not all of them, but almost all. And they came from countries around the world. They were Westerners. So some of them came from New Zealand, some from Australia, Norway, Canada, the United States, England, Finland even. We were this odd assemblage of people who had in common a evangelical outlook that was Christian and Protestant. There were occasional Ethiopian kids who also came to the school, usually through the church or sometimes through company families that had money to pay for them to be there. It was a bit too much of a Western island. Today, actually, the same school is, I think, over 50% Ethiopian or African students, which I think is a good development. But at the time, we were kind of our own little oasis of Western culture in the middle of the larger context.
You were also in the middle, almost in the middle of a war zone. When you were drifting off to sleep at night, you'd hear machine gun fire.
Yes. I even saw it on an occasion or two in the night across the fence line from us, and knew that there were people breaking down doors, assassins basically, or sometimes military soldiers who were arresting people that they considered enemies of the state. So we constantly were aware that all around us was this war. One of the odd things that happened was that that created a tight bond between those who were there at the school, a bond that still is very strong for me and hasn't been replicated. I think maybe people who go off to war find that they're very tightly united with those who they shared that experience with, people who felt besieged and had to be close and support each other.
You were hearing all of these things. You were experiencing your bus going through checkpoints. You describe a number of experiences where you felt like you were in physical danger yourself. There was a point where you were looking out a bus window and a soldier actually pretended that he was going to shoot you.
Yes.
As you were having these incredible, intense experiences, you were far away from your parents. Did that shake your faith to not be in the family unit with them where the faith was so strong and talked about every day? And here you were, you're 16 years old, a time when a lot of us question anyway, seeing so much. Did that shake you?
Yeah, it did. I think when I actually had that machine gun swivel and point at me, there isn't much in life that is more extreme than that. And the question, you know, was raised, was I really safe? Was I really in the hands of God? Would I be okay? And I didn't have the parents there. The odd thing, though, is that especially having lived in Ethiopia earlier and having been sent off to boarding school, whether that was right or wrong, it was a kind of learned way of life. So I didn't know anything other. And it seemed, you know, the other friends that were with me were in the same boat. This is the way we do things. I do think it created a lot of anxieties, larger than I knew at the time, that still impact me. I think the same is true of people that I've known who were in the mission, fellow missionary kids, as we called ourselves.
Are you talking about PTSD, or what are you talking about?
We didn't have that term back then. I just know that these things don't go away, that later you find yourself still impacted. When we landed in Kenya after having to leave Ethiopia and I went to another boarding school there, I do remember one morning being in a strange, foreign, new place with new roommates that I didn't know at all, hearing a loud pop. And I was just waking up. I rolled out of bed instantly and under the bed, thinking that now it's happening, you know, they're coming. And it was just somebody had tossed a rock on the roof. So, yes, I think that without understanding it at that age, there was a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder of sorts. And there weren't tools for talking about it. So we went on with life. And got through it. Wasn't as severe as some other people go through, but it had its impact.
Right. You also write about a shift in how you practiced your faith when you were at boarding school. There was an early devotion every day that at 7 a.m. that you were voluntarily a part of, something you felt was an important part of your faith. But 7 a.m. is really early.
Yeah.
So you had a hard time getting out of bed.
Yeah.
And you'd always felt that it was an optional thing, something you did because you wanted to. And then you got a note from one of the mission couples that was involved with the school.
Right.
Tell me about that note.
Oh, he was saying, you know, the Lord expects us to give him priority and to come together in the morning, ideally, so that we're actually showing attention immediately. And what will these other students think if you are lagging and not coming?
He framed you as a rebel.
Right.
Not a sleepy kid.
Right. And it was just wrong. The fact was that I had a strong drive in me myself without that outside influence to pray, keep my own devotions. I kept them, you know, at like 10:30 or midnight. When I was awake.
Right. So did that shift in how you were treated? I mean, your parents had treated you as really a full partner in faith in many ways. You felt that kind of partnership. You felt like you had volunteered to come to Ethiopia to make a difference when you were out on school holidays. You worked with your father in the clinic and you were with people. You felt like you were doing something important. Did that being treated as a rebellious teenager and being told that, you know, these are things that you have to do to prove your faith, to practice your faith, did that change your feelings about the church?
Yeah. It was an initial crack in kind of the structure or the foundation of my own faith. There would be more, and it would get harder and harder over time. I wanted badly to be the best Christian possible, and so it called that into question. There was guilt. There was also anger, and I began to see, I think, even at that age, that something was wrong with this attitude, this mentality. As the adult looking back, where I write more from experience and look back at that innocent kid who is going through it, I see that evangelical subculture was as works-oriented, that's a term they often threw at the Catholics or other denominations, as anybody else. Works-oriented means basically that faith is something you earn by, you know, checking off what you've done, basically. And it goes counter to the very principle of grace, which is touted and used constantly in sermons within the evangelical church. So here I was being asked to keep a practice, and that was, you know, absolutely critical, and with it went not swearing, not drinking, not smoking, and all the other things that could be given as injunctions for a young person. So, you know, I became cynical about that slowly, and look back now with, you know, clearer eyes at how there was a kind of hypocrisy at work there.
I'm talking with Tim Bascom, author of Running to the Fire, An American Missionary Comes of Age in Revolutionary Ethiopia. In the book, you write about what eventually happened. Your family was basically driven out of Ethiopia. The danger became too great for missionaries and for people who were associated with missions. You really had to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about a night you were with your father in the car? This was the end. You were trying to get out of Ethiopia. You're driving, and a woman runs into the road. She has a child on her back. Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah. We were just about to leave. We were trying to get to an airline office to check on the tickets that we would need for flying out. and Dad is blind in one eye. He lost it when he was in high school from a freak accident at a rifle range. And somebody ran out in the rain from the left side of the road into the street, and he didn't see that immediately, probably because he was looking to the right. I shouted, "Dad, watch out." He turned and noticed and then swung the wheel trying to avoid hitting her. She had a child on her back and had a cloth pulled down over her face so that she wouldn't get wet and wasn't really looking. So she didn't jump out of the way. We didn't turn quite enough, and we caught her with the right headlight. And there was just a sudden thump, thump, and she flew over the hood and then fell to the ground, and we screeched to a halt. Dad ran back, just, you know, mortified. We threw the car doors open and ran back, my younger brother and I. And in the rain, she was lying there on the road in great pain and calling out. She tried to stand and couldn't. Dad was trying to help her and trying to keep her down because he's a doctor, and he was thinking she may have a broken hip or thigh bone. And finally, because she was so insistent, helped her to the side of the road. As he stood there trying to ask her if he could take her to the hospital, and her seeming just alarmed and the baby starting to cry on her back and us wondering if the child was hurt, a crowd formed around us. And it was obvious that they were not happy with what had occurred. And a young man started to ask, "Is this what you do to our people?" In English. An Ethiopian who had just passed by stopped and leaned over and said, "Doctor, you have to leave now." And I recognized him, and he worked for a church organization and had been living at the house my parents had been overseeing for community development workers. And Dad didn't want to step back. Here he'd spent all these years helping people who were injured. Now he had caused the injury. And this man said, "You have to leave. You have to get up. You have to leave now," because he was hearing in Amharic the rising anger and what it might lead to. And
you could have been in the middle of a mob.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
So Dad emptied his wallet and put it into the hands of this woman, and this Ethiopian man, who was quite brave and trying to help, sort of distracted people. We jumped in the car and drove off.
And there are so many moments in the book where you talk about your family being in danger and your father never backing down, always talking about his faith, even
right.
when he really shouldn't have been talking about his faith.
Right.
This is the one moment where he takes the safety of his family as his top priority and gets out of there.
Yeah.
And you and your father never talked about this moment with each other?
We still haven't.
Wow.
I think, you know, I can only assume that for him it's kind of tinged yellow, and it's not an easy thing to talk about. I think we could. Maybe I will. Maybe when I head home next time. Got a family reunion coming. Maybe I'll ask him, "What about that moment?" I know that he's read the book, but we haven't talked about it.
In spending this time looking back, as you said, this was one of the happiest years of your life. It was certainly a year that shaped you in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at this experience now from the perspective of so many years later, and from an adult perspective, from the perspective of a man whose faith has evolved and changed a great deal from that time, what do you take away from your family's experience? What was the value in that?
Boy, you ask difficult questions. Now, I think that I myself learned a lot from watching my parents live large and give themselves over to something they felt was right. I think I am not geared to do the same, but would want to, in my life, find how I can give myself over to what seems right too. I think the Ethiopian people that I got to know, particularly through the church, were remarkable. And in an odd way, though I have changed a lot in how I approach matters of spirituality and faith, they remain kind of a bedrock for me of belief, and I'm thankful for them.
Tim, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you. It's been good.
Tim Bascom is the director of creative writing at Waldorf College in Forest City. He's also the author of Running to the Fire, An American Missionary Comes of Age in Revolutionary Ethiopia. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.